From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 12 candidates take the stage tonight in Westerville, Ohio, for the fourth Democratic debate. Let's see, what's happened since the last one? Anything? Well, only that House Democrats launched an impeachment inquiry. Elizabeth Warren surged to the top of the polls, now rivaling Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders had a heart attack. Also, all heck broke loose in Syria when President Trump made the unilateral decision to announce a U.S. troop withdrawal. Let's bring in NPR's political correspondent, Asma Khalid. Asma, nothing going on, right?
I would say this debate seems like perhaps the biggest wild card, I would say, we've had in this campaign cycle to date.
Yeah. Well, the number of Americans in polling who want to see at least the impeachment inquiry carried out has been inching up. So let's start there. Mm-hmm. Where do the candidates stand on actual impeachment or trial or inquiry, which happens in the House, or possible conviction and removal of President Trump? Where do the candidates stand?
So on the actual impeachment inquiry, at this point, Robin, we have pretty unanimous agreement amongst the Democratic presidential candidates that they think that this should be moving forward, that this is worthy of an impeachment inquiry. And, you know, I would say that the person who had been actually perhaps the most hesitant to go there on this issue was Joe Biden, who had been kind of at the epicenter of, in fact, why the Democrats in the House have launched an impeachment inquiry. But, you know, he is somebody who was there for the impeachment of Nixon and there for the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And so he, you know, has seen how this all plays out. And there was, I think, a desire for him to just be cautious given the ramifications of all of this. But last week, you know, he was pretty vocal as well, saying that there needs to be something done in terms of an impeachment. I would say, look, at the end of the day, the person who has been perhaps the most vocal on this from the beginning, when we look back even at the Mueller report, has been Elizabeth Warren. And so there are gradations, you could say, but at this point, you have pretty unanimous agreement amongst the Democratic candidates.
Well, when you say that Biden was, in a way, at the center of the impeachment inquiry, you're referring to that phone call President Trump made to the Ukrainian president asking that Biden be investigated. Now, let's remind ourselves, because his favorability ratings have ticked down since that call and the claims that came. So remind ourselves, Biden was spearheading a global move to get a Ukrainian prosecutor fired because not because that prosecutor was investigating a company that Biden's son worked at, but because he wasn't investigating enough. President Trump and Rudy Giuliani said the opposite. They said the prosecutor was fired to protect Biden's son. Again, not true. But there was a lot of head shaking, even among Democrats, about Hunter Biden working there. Today he told ABC it was a mistake. But what do the candidates do tonight? You know, support one of their own, a Democrat, Biden, or go after this vulnerable story?
Well, to date, Robin, the other Democratic candidates running have been extremely reticent to even engage on this topic, to even engage in whether there might have been a perceived conflict of interest.
Yeah, but they're going to be asked.
And you're right. They are going to be asked. And that's what I was going to say. I think that's what's going to be different, is that when they have been asked by journalists, they have tried to shut the conversation down often. I was with Kamala Harris recently in California. She was asked, she told reporters, you know, leave Joe Biden alone. They don't want to go there. I think the dynamics are going to be fundamentally different when they're on a debate stage and the moderators just don't let the topic go. And they will be repeatedly likely asked about this. Yeah. So, I mean, look, my guess is as best as yours as to how this is going to be dealt with. I think that you can read through the signs, and you can get that a candidate like Elizabeth Warren, who has essentially run on the platform of corruption, has been very vocal about lobbying and foreign lobbying and interventions and whatnot. You have a sense, and when you talk to her supporters, you know where they stand on the issue. Whether or not, though, you have, you know, and a wholesale like engagement or condemnation of this, I don't know that I'm going to see that. Because in part, Robin, part of this is that the Democrats are really hesitant to engage on Donald Trump's turf. Yeah. And so Donald Trump has exasperated and exaggerated and I would argue, you know, has completely kind of falsified the original root of this story. And so now Democrats feel hesitant to even say, was the fact that Joe Biden's son working on the board of a foreign company at the time that Joe Biden was vice president, was that appropriate? So far, the candidates have not even really wanted to engage on that specific question.
So this is the CNN New York Times Democratic presidential debate. It's tonight at 8 Eastern, live on CNN. You can hear it on many NPR stations. Just very briefly, Asma Khalid, Bernie Sanders, you know, he cut back his schedule after suffering that heart attack 2 weeks ago, but he's fighting. He called his fellow progressive Elizabeth Warren a capitalist to her bones. You know, he's the Democratic Socialist. What will you be watching from him tonight?
So part of what I'm really curious to see, Robin, is just physically how he how he's perceived on stage. You mentioned he did have a heart attack. He had been running an exorbitantly, really, you know, sort of dynamic campaign. He was a heavy campaigner. He would have a lot of rallies, a really sort of robust campaign schedule. He has not been physically present since that heart attack. And we haven't seen him on the campaign trail. So this is, in some ways, the opportunity for the public, for us even as journalists, to really get a sense of how he's been doing and what he looks like. And these debates are long, right? Yeah. They're 2+ hours. What I'm interested in is that.
Yeah. NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's safe to say President Trump is dealing with a major foreign policy problem right now. The fallout from his decision to pull American troops out of northern Syria has cleared the way for Turkey to target the Kurds, who had been allies of the U.S. in the fight against ISIS. President Trump has now leveled new sanctions against Turkey after receiving lots of criticism about his decision and Turkey's military action. But he also tweeted this, quote, "Anyone who wants to assist Syria in protecting the Kurds is good with me, whether it is Russia, China, or Napoleon Bonaparte. I hope they all do great. We are 7,000 miles away!" Exclamation point. Let's bring in Julian Zelizar. He is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks for being here. Well, this all feels like a foreign policy crisis for Trump, to say the least. Give us some context, is it?
Well, I think that's fair to say, both from the instability that has now developed in the region to the solidification of Syrian power in this region and to the release of ISIS prisoners. All of this is a real mess, and it can directly be connected to the decision that the president made. So if you have a textbook definition of a foreign policy crisis, I think this would fit.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about messaging for a little bit and what this signals to Turkey. First, Trump said he'd pull the troops out of northern Syria. And really, he had to know that Turkey would then target the Kurds. And then this criticism after he announced these sanctions. Is this mixed messaging for Turkey? Kind of lay this all out for us.
Well, sure. The president has not clearly been working with a set of advisors on this. The way in which this unfolded was haphazard. And it's clear that the president should have known that this would be the response. And he was essentially giving a green light to this. And then retroactively, he's now trying to impose sanctions on Turkey, although there are questions about how serious those really are or how substantive they really are. So there is no messaging, and we don't know what the motivations were behind this decision, whether it was impulsive or whether there's something else that we're missing. And because of the context in which this takes place, the impeachment context, I think those are questions being raised.
Right. I wonder how much of this and what's happening today is the result of overall American policy toward the Middle East, really going back to President George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq back in 2003. Can you draw a line from there to where we are now?
Well, it's always hard to draw a straight line from one decision to an event that takes place many years later. But clearly, it created a lot of instability in the region. And some of the networks that are involved in this whole battle come out of that war. It also created a leeriness in the United States among presidents to intervene. President Obama didn't want to fully intervene in the Syria civil war as it unfolded, in part because of the wariness in this country that came out of Iraq. And so I think, you know, this is all in the shadow of President George W. Bush's decisions.
Yeah. And really, I'm wondering how much foreign policy issues overall and these decisions shape a presidential legacy.
Very important in the long term. We often remember what a president did on foreign policy, often the mistakes, Vietnam and Lyndon Johnson, Iraq and George W. Bush, and that can overshadow everything else. And in this case, it's doubly important because the questions of how President Trump is handling this crisis and why he did what he did are directly connected to the domestic political turmoil that he now faces. So this can have an even more immediate consequential effect on his legacy via impeachment or the 2020 election.
Yeah, we were just listening to what we can expect from the Democratic debates tonight. How much would you like to see this discussed about Syria and foreign policy in tonight's Democratic debate?
I think it'll be a substantial part of the discussion, and it should. There are big questions about what this says about him as a leader and how he's conducting himself with this presidential power. And so Democrats are going to certainly jump on this. It's an easy way to highlight the risks of continuing with the Trump presidency. And so they don't want to back away. And it's an issue where they can point to national security conservatives, even some congressional Republicans who are equally upset with what happened. So I think you're going to hear a bit of this tonight.
Julian Zeldazar is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, as always, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
You may read Gail Collins' column in the New York Times. She's been writing it since 1995. She also served as the editorial page editor from 2001 to 2007, the first woman to hold that position. So if you're doing the math, you may be thinking she should just curl up in a fetal position and exit the stage, right? Because, well, she can't be young. Well, thank goodness this isn't the 1830s when elderly women at dancing parties in America were literally sidelined spectators as the young people danced. Oh, and back then, elderly meant in their 30s. In colonial times in early America, women had clout as they aged because they knew how to do things like eat or make light with candles. At other times in history, they were expected to have their babies shrivel up from menopause and go away. Gail Collins' latest book, her seventh, traces the history of women aging in America, some of them lost to history but found here. None of them put their dogs in a crate on top of their car on a drive to Canada. I'm sorry, we can't talk to Gail Collins without referencing, as she did for years, the fact that then-presidential candidate Mitt Romney did just that. Her book is No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History, and she joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Gail, welcome back.
Thank you.
This is overwhelming. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, you know, I first got the idea when I was writing one of my previous women's history books, and I ran across this letter from the very early male colonists who were desperately writing back to England looking for wives because there were no women there for them to marry, and saying their qualifications were must be civil and under 50 years of age. And I thought, wow, the vision of what a young woman is changed a lot over the years. And, you know, until you got to the point where in the late 1800s in the cities, if you were 22 and you weren't married, people worried about you.
Right.
So it's gone up and down and in and out. And then I my second thing that just completely freaked me out, when I first started to think about writing it, I thought I might call it You're Not Getting Older, You're Getting Better, because of that old commercial
right.
from the 70s, you know, that about hair coloring.
You're not getting older, you're getting better and getting to me.
Loving Care, the hair color that gives you not just better color, better hair. You're not getting older. You're getting better.
I looked up that ad, and the ad begins. This is in 1970-something. These days, if a woman is over 25, she's considered old. And I thought, wow.
What?
I was around for that. I was around for that. What
you didn't
happened?
Even know that. Well, that's one of the through lines of the book is, as you say, how different things were in early America. They, you know, maybe because men were so desperate for women, we'd like to think they understood that a 50-year-old woman could be a good companion. But you do point out that, you know, in that time, there was also a respect for women because they did know how to do things. But then you get, you know, the early 1900s. Women who were achieving so much in the late 1800s had to step aside for 19-year-old flappers.
Everything that you look at in history, I'm sorry to say, comes down to economics in some way, shape, or form. Early American housewives were really, really valuable. They made all the stuff the family needed, the food. They made candles. They made butter. They grew chickens. They had a huge economy going on that really supported their families. And then when people moved to the cities, there was really nothing much for women to do in the house except have babies. And at that point, people lost total interest in any woman that was beyond childbearing age. Yeah. She just had no point at all. And then when we moved on again and suddenly people started working, and especially when you hit the post-war era in America, when people got used to the idea that everybody should be middle class and live in a suburb and have a certain standard of living, and then the 70s kicked in and the economy wouldn't support it on one income, the idea that women were going to be needed to work, even if they were married and had children, transformed everything. Once you're a good earner, you have the same status as a man when it comes to age.
Well, by the way, I want to point out that this is a history of women and aging in America. And you're quick to point out that at times when it's just horrible for elderly white women, you always point out along the way when it was far worse for elderly black women.
Yeah.
Even elderly men who...
Actually, in some ways, it was worse. African-American homes tended to be more welcoming of relatives than many white homes. But if you didn't have enough money to support the family, then nobody was welcome. And to be honest, it was even worse for men, because at least if you had an older woman, she could help with the housework and stuff like that. And older men were just beyond the pale. There was just nothing you could do with them.
Right. Nobody wanted them around. Well, with that caveat, in the colonial era, people actually thought it might be illegal to wear makeup.
Yeah. The state legislatures for a long time, and you can count on state legislators, they will do anything. But frequently, bills would come up early on suggesting that it be illegal to dye your hair or to wear makeup, because the idea was you were trying to trick a man into marrying you by making him think you were younger than you really were.
But then we're reminded, I mean, there's so many through lines here. You go ahead, about 400 pages, and there we are in the 1970s, and it doesn't feel that much more advanced when people have to sign petitions to get their employers to let them wear slacks, pants. This is in the 70s. When you couple them together in the same book, it doesn't feel like much has changed.
But then not so much longer after that, all the women in the federal government were allowed to wear slacks because there was an energy crisis. And people thought, well, keep them warm. You know, that's the least we can do. So things do move along, I have to say.
Sometimes slowly. But could we just take some more topics? Gray hair, for instance. We talked about the ad that now that was encouraging women to dye their hair at a time women would desperately start putting on caps and things to cover their hair because they were desperate not to show their age.
Yeah, there's a great picture of Dolly Madison wearing one of those caps that cover your entire hair. And there's three little phony black curls pooping out from the sides of it.
They're sewn to the caps.
Yeah. Once it became easy to color your hair and it looked natural, things were transformed. My friend Nora Ephron said, you know, the great transformation of women is not because of any feminism. It's because of hair dye. Once you could not get gray hair, you could do so many things for so much longer. And it's absolutely true. It really was transformative.
Talk about some of the important names from American history, including one of the architects of the women's rights movement, Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
She is one of my favorites, I've got to say. Yes. And she has many great contributions, but the one that really tickled me anyway was that she was around at a point in which it was considered shocking for women to speak out in public. That was just not their role. They were supposed to stay home with the kids, and people would get stoned and buildings would be burned down if there was a woman orator trying to speak about political matters. And she figured out that what you could do was just to look old, and she made a very big point of looking very matronly. She had gray hair. She talked about being a grandmother constantly. And she found that if you presented yourself as an old woman, you could get away with anything. And she would be running around the country playing cards with the soldiers and talking about not just about abolition, which was her great cause, but about divorce reform, anything, as long as she looked like this little old grandmother.
Because this was at a point in American history when that safe maternal grandmother was embraced.
Yes.
The padding had something to do with it because Susan B. Anthony, who, you know, had a parallel life to hers, except she was single and very thin, she had a harder time going out
in
public.
Yes, yes. It was like that stripped down spinster look that they found so unappealing.
And talking about menopause, it was seen as you might as well just put a fork in your eye to something that was liberating and a challenge to women to go out and do something for someone else, to volunteer, to have women's clubs. It was a whole other mindset.
Yeah, and it's interesting that we're talking about the pre-Civil War era with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Once the idea came around that once you were older, you could go out and do stuff, you could be a public person, people started writing odes to menopause. Oh, glorious freedom. Here we are. We can go out and do things in the world. And then you started a little bit later, but still in the 19th century, to have doctors who not only regarded menopause as an aging bad thing, but sort of as a sign of incipient insanity. There were strong feelings that if you had sex after menopause, you would go nuts. And suddenly you had doctors experimenting with like putting chimpanzee ovaries in women and all this kind of strange stuff. And it was supposed to keep off aging forever. And it moved into hormone replacement therapy, which was huge, huge, huge back in the 70s and the 80s until it was discovered that it was actually dangerous. Mm.
There's so much in here. You know, I just urge people to pick it up and then put it down when it makes you angry and pick it up again.
Thank you so much.
How are you? You know, how do you mind my asking how old you are and how you're feeling about it?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, it's different now. It used to be you could lie about your age, but it's really tough to lie about your age when you're on Wikipedia.
Yes, Google. I mean,
you know, so I'm 73. But we had a party the other night when the book came out. Some friends of mine gave me a party. And there was one woman there who I have been friends with since the Eisenhower administration. Mm. My husband, who I've been married to for almost 50 years now, there are all these people who I've gotten over all these years and I've gotten to stay with. And just that community of friends and loved ones gets bigger and better all the time. And so it's a celebration for me.
Yeah. Gail Collins, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And to read an excerpt of Gail's book, No Stopping Us Now, go to hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And today, Walmart announced it's rolling out a new grocery delivery program with employees putting food right in your fridge called InHome. It's being tested out in Pittsburgh, Kansas City, and Vero Beach, Florida, starting this week. It's Walmart's attempt to keep up with Amazon and others trying to capture the big and growing online food delivery market. Sharice Jones of USA Today is here to talk about it. Hi, Sharice.
Hello.
So a delivery person comes in your house? How's this going to work?
Well, basically, if you live in one of those three cities, you go on Walmart.com and you see if your address is eligible, and then you sign up for the service. It's about $20 a month, and a Walmart employee will buy your carrots and your apples and your toothpaste, and they'll bring the purchases right into your kitchen or into your garage if that's what you prefer. And when you get home, everything's there.
Well, we understand that part of enlisting, you know, because I'm thinking, wait, who, what? Part of enrolling in this is that you have to buy a certain kind of smart door lock?
Yeah, it's about $50, which is, in comparison to Amazon, a little bit cheaper. They've got a service, too, that costs a little bit more. And basically, the employee's going to be wearing a camera. And so you'll see the delivery happening in real time on your smartphone so you can feel comfortable with it. Yeah. And if you're not comfortable, you can stop the service. But that's a way to kind of get you across that threshold.
So all the smart technology gets the employee in. There's a camera so you can watch. They can't get in without the camera rolling. And they are going to be highly vetted. But still, what's going on here? Because as you mentioned, online grocery sales are going to be about 20% of the market by 2025. They're right now about 4%. It's obviously, you know, everybody's heading for that big 20%, but that still means 80% of shopping is done in stores. And in, if you're in a store shopping, it seems to me it's better for the store because you buy those stupid things by the counter you don't need. You buy all that stuff you don't need.
Well, I think that this is going to be more for the essentials, right? It's for the toilet paper that you're always going to have to restock and the lunchtime snacks and that kind of thing. And for the longer shopping list, you're still going to want to head out to the supermarket and do your own shopping. So it's more a convenience for busy parents and folks who are at work all day to get those things that they've always got to refill.
And again, other people are doing this. So Walmart now is going to bring it into your fridge. You can get it into your garage, the trunk of your car. I'm assuming someday the delivery person will bring it in and cook it for you.
That would be great.
Who else are these people going after?
Well, I think they're really going after the working folks, right? I mean, if you're at home, you're there for the delivery. But if you're a working mom and you want to bake the cookies when you get home from work and get it done before the kids go to bed, you may not want to run out to the supermarket to get the ingredients. And so it's a real convenience for those parents that are out there working all day or on the weekend, you want to spend time with your kids and not be at the supermarket all afternoon.
And just, I mean, so many people are starting to do this, the food delivery. Is there a concern that it might get too fractured?
I don't know if everybody's going to have the technology to bring it into your home. I mean, I think people are competing for convenience, and there's nothing more convenient than that. So I think that people are going to still kind of distinguish themselves in that regard.
We should say this whole idea of this technology with the smart lock and, you know, it goes on to your existing deadbolt lock, and that's how it works. But some Walmart employees in a think tank came up with it, and they just got a big promotion. Charisse Jones from USA Today, thanks as always for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Have you noticed the music or the fashions out right now? It's like we've gone back in time. I felt this in a big way when I watched the Grammy Awards last year. That's Bruno Mars and Cardi B singing a song that sounds straight out of the 90s. And their clothes, oversized shorts and shirts, yellow, red, green, and blue, the signature look of the look back then, cross colors, clothing without prejudice. The clothing company started 30 years ago, and if Bruno and Cardi B are any indication, it's making a comeback. To talk with us more about the influence of cross colors, past and present, is Thomas T.J. Walker, co-founder of the iconic brand. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya and NPR, for actually having me here.
Okay, 30 years ago. I'm not that old, TJ. What's going on?
You know, my business partner and I, Carl Jones, when we actually had someone come to us and say, you guys, it's 30 years, right? And we were like, No.
That was 10 years ago. What are you talking about?
Of course it was 10 years ago.
I know. Well, take us back to that time, 1989, here in L.A., you and your partner, as you mentioned, your co-founder, Carl Jones, started this brand. You initially wanted to call it Cross Cultures, but decided on Cross Colors, Clothing Without Prejudice. That's a very bold name, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the meaning of that, especially during that time. We're talking 89, 90.
Right. Well, my business partner and I, we actually had the name, and we started with the name Cross Cultures because we really want something to be inclusive, and we wanted to identify with the culture. But when we actually did our research, we actually found out that the name was taken. And because we had done so much branding and so much design work based on the two C's, we decided to do Cross Colors. Mm. And our marketing director actually is, he's actually from Jamaica. And the way we spell it is actually from the British way of spelling it. So we kind of put a twist on it.
C-O-L-O-U-R-S.
Yes, instead of the normal way, or at least the American way. Yeah. So with that, too, the name actually had a great and deeper meaning for us, too. and it actually came during the 89, 90s. There were a lot of things going on.
Yeah. Gang violence.
Gang violence and those kind of things. And so with that, the gangs themselves were identified by colors. I know here in Los Angeles. And we wanted to do something that kind of, you know, dissolved that and kind of unified that too as well. So that too is really a huge part of why we actually call the brand Cross Colors.
Yeah, a bringing of all of those primary colors.
Yes, to bring them together, you know.
You and your co-founder, Carl, were very astute to street fashion in conceptualizing this. You took a trip to New York to People Watch. What did you discover?
We actually were taking trips to New York for inspiration and also doing some research, you know, in terms of trying to see what we were going to do. And with that, we actually, on occasion, we would just sit and watch, and we saw, and even on the subways and things like that, we saw how the youth were dressing at the time. Mm. They were dressing with the hoodies and the pants and
these big pants that are several sizes too big.
Yeah, they would be a size 30, and they'd have on a size 36 pant, and it would be all belted, but the waist didn't fit. Mm. So we decided we would actually do something that actually helped to support that. And at that time, we called it the hookup.
The hookup.
Yeah, it was all the way from the head to the actual toe of the actual individual to actually make sure we actually had everything coordinated for them.
Yeah, and that became a signature look of that time. Other brands started to kind of take notice and change their aesthetic as well.
Right, right. At the time in 89, there weren't many colors that were actually represented in the stores. They were usually like just khakis and navy and black. But we actually went to do something to actually kind of turn the tide on that as well, you know, with the colors that we actually had.
Taking from street fashion, I think the first person I remember wearing Cross Colors was Will Smith and the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And then you were just everywhere. We're talking In Living Color with Jamie Foxx and Jim Carrey. The group TLC wore Cross Colors. Snoop Dogg, Muhammad Ali, even Stevie Wonder.
I know.
I saw him in overalls.
He came to our facility quite a bit.
Yeah. Really?
Yes, he did. Yeah. He was like part of the family.
Wow.
And I think that's what was so amazing about the brand is that people were just gravitated to the brand. And they felt ownership of the brand, too, as well.
Do you think it was the message as well as the aesthetic?
Definitely the message. I mean, we started with, you know, saying that we wanted to, you know, focus on things like education and unity. And our tagline itself, you know, which we still use today, Clothing Without Prejudice, is really the DNA of the brand.
Yeah, we're going to get to today, but the early 90s was really interesting because it was a special time for Black designers. I mean, of course, there were you guys, Cross Colors, but I remember FUBU,
right.
Mecca, Iniche,
yeah.
Which we always had a problem saying
that.
Iniche, P&B. There were so many brands, but they seemed to soften and fade away as we got into the mid and late 90s. Was that a coincidence, or what was the reasoning, or something more?
A big reason was, I think, is because of what we call trends. Mm. You know, things trend in and they trend out. I mean, today we have a resurgence of it because everything's cyclical for the most part, and it comes back. But I think it's back in a different way this time, too, as
well. Oh, describe what you mean.
Well, there's a deeper-rooted movement going on, you know, where the youth are actually wanting to see some change in things. And I think we are kind of representational of that change that was back in the 90s because it changed when we came about. But not that we're the only ones. I'm just saying that people are now back to natural hair and these things that are more in terms of thinking of the environment and humanity, too, as well. Mm. I think those are the things that are enrooted and getting ingrained into the youth today, which I see is really, it's really nice to see.
It's nice, and they've discovered your brand. I want to know, you all came back in a very intentional way in 2014. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that the youth were gravitating in this direction, or did you just say, hey, we're going to start, and then they came to you? What was first?
Well, you know, I think we felt that it was time to bring it back. I mean, things like Cardi B, Bruno Mars wearing the product and loving it, and just things happening organically with the brand. And we actually kind of, we have to follow along.
Follow along with what people want with the brand. There is now a Cross Colors exhibit at the California African American Museum here called Cross Colors, Black Fashion in the 20th Century.
Yes.
It follows the historic route of the brand created for Black youth culture back in the day. What do you want people to take away from this retrospective?
You know, I think that's what I want them to take away, the retrospective, because they curate it in a way where they can go to a historical perspective of who the individuals were that we actually based the colors on, the movements that were actually relevant for the brand and how it actually helped impact us. I don't really want to give a lot away about what they're going to see, but they're going to be overwhelmed. Mm. I was.
You
and
were
I
overwhelmed.
Am. I am.
Tell me that feeling when you walked in and saw it.
It's overwhelming, but also the educational value of the brand. Not just people of color, but people all over should actually learn how to see from the eyes of others, basically. Because I think we don't do that enough.
That's Thomas T.J. Walker, co-founder of Cross Colors. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanya.
We asked you to share some of your favorite cross-color memories with us. Here's some of what you shared.
My fondest memory of cross-color, I just remember being so happy, being that I was involved heavily in hip-hop, that it was a black-owned brand that came out that was influencing the culture that I was so much in love with.
My Cross Color story really basically reflects on how it hit the scene hard and fast. As a person who actually followed fashion, even as a kid, it was extremely important because it was literally the first time that I saw a brand that looked like it was made for us.
I was about 12 when Cross Color really took off. I went for back to school shopping that year, and I got myself a Cross Color short set. It was like a baseball jersey and some shorts to go with it. And I wore my Cross Color and was so proud of it at school. Not just cool clothes, but it was also like a cultural statement. So I was really proud of it. It was dope. It's late in the day and I ain't been on the court yet. Hustle to the mall to get me a short set. Yeah, I got on sneaks, but I need a new pair. Cause basketball court in the summer got girls there. The temperature's about 88. Hop in the water plug, just for old time's sake. Break to your crib, change your clothes once more. Cause you're invited to a barbecue to start at 4. Sitting with your friends, y'all reminisce about the days growing up and the first person you kiss. Harold Bloom died yesterday at 89. He was often called the most notorious literary critic in America. He loved the classics, but would also go on Good Morning America to talk about the literary world, which he sometimes saw in decline. He didn't like Harry Potter or the idea of Stephen King getting a National Book Award or other things. But oh, how Harold Bloom loved poems. We spoke in 2010 when he just published Till I End My Song, A Gathering of Last Poems, featuring the last works of 100 poets. Listening back, we realized how sustaining poetry was.
It really makes life more vivid and finer. It's kept me alive in crisis after crisis since between 70 and 80. I've had 6 near-death experiences, as it were.
Then those near-death experiences included 2 heart attacks, and he was walking in wool socks brooding about poetry when, whoosh, he slipped and broke several vertebrae. So he spoke with us from his convalescence in New Haven, and we listened as he held forth on this gathering of last poems.
I suppose I set out to create this gathering because I had been fascinated by the whole question of lastness in poetry. Really, since I was very young, I'm 80 years old now, and I started reading poetry passionately when I was about 9 or 10. One of the great functions of poetry, and I think that's the central purpose of this book, here are 100 poems that really teach us how to live better with uncertainty. And whatever your age, you need to know how to live with uncertainty, whether or not it is the uncertainty of just how long you will last. And of course, no matter what our ages are, we never do know that mystery.
Well, and that becomes so clear when we read all of the prefaces to the poems you write about the poets. So many of them died young. And so many of the works here may be familiar, but you ask us to look at them in a new way. For instance, Tennyson's Crossing the Bar. You write, it's almost too famous. The first stanza, sunset and evening star and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea. But you say, take a close look at the second stanza.
Yes. But such a tide as moving seems asleep to fall for sound and foam when that which drew from out the boundless deep turns again home, and then, very beautifully, twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark. And may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark. It's a very considerable question of it could be any voyage, though he may indeed mean the final voyage. You know, I had a very personal motive in putting the book together. 56 of these 100 poems could be considered modern poets. Of those 56 poets, 24 are people I knew and cared for personally. 17 were at least good acquaintances. 7 were among my closest friends, and 1 heartbreakingly may well have been my closest friend ever, whom I continue to mourn, Archie Ammons. And this is quite literally, I think, Archie's last poem. I remember he sent it to me. There are moments in this poem which will always haunt me. Begins, the people of my time are passing away. My wife is baking for a funeral, a 60-year-old who died suddenly, when the phone rings and then it starts mentioning people who are in fact people I know and cared for a great deal. And then he says something very beautifully. We have already lost so many. Brush the loss of ourselves, our address books for so long, a slow scramble now, our palimpsest scribble and scratches, and then goes on to say, but we don't give up on people. We are hanging on with a grip to the ones left. We are not giving up on the congestive heart failures or brain tumors. And as he goes on talking about this, he says, until we die, we will remember every single thing, recall every word, love every loss. Then we will, as we must, leave it to others to love, love that can grow brighter and deeper to the very end, gaining strength and getting more precious all the way.
I'm very jealous of you, which I know is a silly statement. I'm talking to Harold Bloom, but that you have this intimacy with these people.
Well, I feel that in a sense I've known all 100 of these poets, though of course I couldn't possibly have known the first 50 or so. But I miss so many of those who are gone, and that was the only sad element in putting together the book, in writing about people I miss so much as Anthony Hecht. His final volume, The Darkness and the Light, in 2001, he died 3 years later in 2004. It concludes with this poem, and it's the very last poem in his last book. I won't read all of it. He writes, like the elderly and frail who've lasted through the night, cold brows and silent lips, for whom the rising light entails their own eclipse, brightening as they fail. That's a perfect line, it seems to me, that failing or falling is also a brightening kind of a process when it's expressed with the power of really sublime poetry. But thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. The image of the sun rising as a life ends is quite something. Thank you so much. You take care. Watch out for those slippery floors.
All right, dear. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this.
Harold Bloom in 2010. His wife Jean said his health had been failing, but he taught at Yale up till last week. Harold Bloom died yesterday at 89. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.